Our second speaker needs really no introduction to this audience, I don't think. The Honourable John Anderson is going to join us now. Here he is. John's currently, amongst other things, chairman of Eastern Star Gas, and today we'll be talking about workforce challenges. Please welcome John.
Well, Lee, thank you very much. This is all working, is it? Mics and so forth are lined up. I appreciate the chance to be with you and salute the fact that you're dedicating time to something that I think matters very much indeed. The future of our rural and regional communities, something that I've spent a lot of time on in my life trying to, if you like, secure a future for. And I think you've got a star-studded lineup of speakers, Leith, I have to say. And by the end of it, I hope some really clear and worthwhile agendas have emerged. It's good of you to have me out. Many of you I've known for a very long time indeed. I have made the transition back to private life in my own mind completely, and I'm a farmer down the road with a couple of off-farm activities, including the involvement that Leith referred to with Eastern Star Gas. Sometimes I get a bit of a surprise when I'm recognised by others for, I suppose, a profile that I might have once had. I was standing in a reception line for a charity in Sydney recently, and a North Shore matron, as it emerged, a very, very nice lady, and I mean her no disrespect, but she came up to me. She was hovering in a way that suggested to me that she had something she wanted to say. And eventually she got close enough to launch into it. She started out brilliantly. She said, "Young man, I know I've seen you many times around Sydney, and I know that you've been active in public life, but I'm very embarrassed to have to say to you that although we've been introduced and I should know your name, I've forgotten it. And I'm going to have to ask you to tell me who you are, because I can't resist the urge to tell you that you bear an extraordinary and uncanny resemblance to that fellow John Anderson who used to be the Deputy Prime Minister." Well, as I said to you, I'd just like to give you a bit of a broad overview of how I see things, some of the things that I think you need to keep in mind, a little bit of history, and some suggestions as to how to go forward from here. And please forgive me, I am not at the centre of the current debate. So to some extent, I hope I'm not living in the past, but it will reflect the experiences of the 90s and the first half of the noughties, or the noughties, or whatever you want to call them. I do, as I said at the outset, think that regional development and a fair go for people who live outside the urban areas of this most urbanised country on earth, I think they are very important concepts indeed. I think they're important economically, and I think they are important for social cohesion. The first thing that strikes me in this context is that the more things change, the more they stay the same. Change is a reality. It doesn't stop. If we'd been gathered here in this place 100 years ago and been contemplating the Australian workforce, we'd have been working in the context of a reality that of Australians who had a job, fully half would have been employed in agriculture or mining. Today, of course, the position is vastly different, despite the astounding rise in the productivity and the output of both sectors. It would be very surprising to me if more than 5% of the Australian workforce was involved in agriculture and mining. And indeed, of course, other great reality that is very much with us is that the three essential industries in rural and regional Australia, being agriculture, mining and tourism as the great employment drivers, are all export focused to a greater or lesser degree. The mining industry is overwhelmingly export focused, to state the obvious. And the extractive industries increasingly, including gas and oil, also because they are not so much mining, I draw a distinction there, the drillers, if you like, increasingly with, although our oil self-sufficiency is plummeting, which is a huge issue for Australia and not spoken about enough, obviously our gas production in a whole range of ways is rising very rapidly indeed, and that has become very strongly export focused as well. Well, the first point that arises out of that recognition is that rural Australia needs good, sound economic and trade policies. This is very often overlooked. The previous speaker made reference to the difficulties that the NFF must experience in seeking to represent rural Australians because so often they are fractious. Now, I'm a farmer and I love farmers, but I know what he was referring to. My wife often talks about the time we're out at Lightning Ridge and we had three tables of 10 wool growers back at, shortly after the collapse of the reserve price scheme. During question time, one table fired an incredible number of questions at me, and I couldn't help making the observation. I said, I think there are 10 of you on that table and you appear to have 10 different opinions. And one of them shot back at me, as a matter of fact, he said, we've got 11. It is very important for rural people to recognise the importance of sound overall policy. So often we focus in on our little local issue, important as that may be, or our particular industry problems, or our particular social problems, and fail to contextualise it in a way that means that you can find enough common ground with other rural people, other regional communities, to develop enough clout to be able to carry Canberra or Macquarie Street on important issues. This division is so often the source of our failure to achieve the policy outcomes we need. And indeed, my own involvement in the Federal Parliament had a lot to do, my willingness, mad when I look back on it, to put my hand up for what is really a dog of a job. It was a great honour and a great privilege, but it's a very tough and difficult life, had to do with the fact that I was very seized by the belief that we had lost our way on the big policy issues and that they were hurting rural and regional Australia. It was playing out with very high interest rates. The time I went into the Federal Parliament, people who were borrowing from the great pastoral houses of the day on the land were paying in real terms 24, 25, 26% interest. Inflation was a real problem. The dollar was overvalued because of the high interest rates. And of course we had real problems in terms of flexibility in the workplace, and that played out very badly for country people who are exporters, with things like inefficient transport and woefully unreliable and inefficient waterfronts. Big policy issues. Very important that they were addressed then. Very important that they be addressed now, and make no mistake about it, if you're talking about labour market participation, over the next few years, unless things are changed, you will see a serious re-emergence of intransigence and inflexibility in the workplace. That is what is going to happen over the next few years unless there are further policy settings, for the very simple reason that the current policy settings go back to a much earlier era, to be blunt about it, pre-Keating. This will play out in a way that will be a big problem again for rural and regional Australia. There can be no doubt about that. The evidence is there because we know what it did in the past. So the big policy issues, they are important. Trade reform remains important. And trade is a two-way street. No country exports, I think this is right, this has changed in the last few years, a higher percentage of its agricultural product as a total percentage, or as a percentage of total production, than Australia. No country. We are dependent upon pursuing every trade opportunity bilaterally and every trade reform we can possibly get multilaterally. Difficult as it is, and easy it is as it becomes to become cynical about those things, the reality is that our jobs and our prosperity in regional Australia, which is so terribly export-focused, is very dependent upon trade working as well as possible. Very easy to lose sight of those things, but please, can I emphasise to you, good policy matters. and the National Farmers Federation, back in the days when I was thinking about what was good policy, led the debate on many important issues, from tax reform through to industrial relations reform, and a whole range of other research and development and transport issues. It was very impressive indeed, and I wish that organisation well as it seeks to do so in the future. Can I say to you, there is another issue that is very, very important and is related, that receives a lot of focus in this day and age in relation to how your workforce works. It's education. We do not get the results, or let me rephrase that, we are not offering our country children yet the same opportunities that city kids have. The outcomes reflect that very clearly. It's not as if country kids are born with lower IQs. The reality, though, is that particularly in maths and science, they're not coming through with the same sort of outcomes that their city counterparts are able to point to. And that's something that needs a lot of addressing, and I would encourage those of you who are touching on that subject, that matter, to be vigorous, and those of you who have not thought it through, to be aware that it is a very big issue. In terms of sourcing people for the jobs that are emerging in rural and regional Australia, a strengthening in that area of maths and science performance is very much needed. The University of New England, to its great credit, has done a lot of work in this area. And indeed, one of the useful things, I hope I did some, I was able to do, was to secure some decent funding for the Maths and Science Centre up there, whereby the university, in some very innovative models, is seeking to work alongside science and maths teachers who often find it very hard in country schools because they don't have the number of students studying to be able to offer the sort of strands and the depth of opportunities in maths and science that city schools can. So it's a question of numbers, often. They're getting that tremendous support out of that university, and that I think is something that's very important. There are a couple of other related issues. Educationally. One is, and I've just touched on it, you need people in rural areas to be able to ensure that you've got sufficient people for all of your services, including your schools. Including your schools. One of the reasons why you need to try and attract as many industries and associated sectors and employees as you possibly can. We held, some of you may remember it, quite a big conference in Canberra on regional development and invited delegates from all over Australia. Some of you might have been at it shortly after I became Deputy Prime Minister in, I think, early 2000. Worth remembering that some of the lessons that came out of that are still applicable today. One of them was as pointed out to us by a very good speaker from the OECD, which is the Paris-based organisation for cooperation between economically developed nations. There's about 32, I think, developed nations, and it's a good free enterprise-oriented body, the OECD, which has enormous stored knowledge, if you like, enormous background and history and corporate know-how on what works in terms of economic and social policy and what doesn't. And they had their speaker, he was a Frenchman, of all nationalities when it comes to talk about sensible economic policy, talking to us about regional development. And he said, you need to understand that, I hope I haven't offended any Frenchmen here today. I love the French, I just don't think that they are very good when it comes to sound economics. They seem to have this idea there's a third way somewhere between capitalism and socialism, and if they work at it hard enough, they'll find it and it'll work. And I don't believe them, to be honest. But anyway, this fellow was able to point to instance again and instance again of times when OECD member countries had tried to prop up an industry when market forces were changing, or prop up an area, only to find that in the end, governments were not able to continue the practice and the fall was worse than the adjustment process would have been if they hadn't put those policies in place. An Australian example, to be blunt about it, was the wool reserve price scheme. Worked well while it was a potholing scheme. Once it became a price support scheme, it's an inevitable collapse when it came, did and has produced untold hardship for wool growers across Australia. But there are numerous other examples the raw figures from both America and Europe on the results of farm subsidisation suggest very strongly that they don't work. For all of the massive farm subsidies in America, their farm failure rate is about the same as Australia's. And in Europe, thus my reference to French economic policies, the farm failure rate, and we all know about their farm subsidy policies, are far higher than Australia. They're higher than Australia, worse. All that happens with those subsidy programs is that the costs get built into the price of capital and into input costs. The margins end up being squeezed to the same degree, it seems. So attempts to prop up either industry sectors or regions invariably fail and invariably hurt badly the very people that they were originally intended to help. Coming to a couple of other issues the other things that I wanted to just draw out of that conference that I think are still relevant. One of the ones that interested me, and which we actually came in the end to do a lot of work on, because I couldn't get my mind around what was being talked about, and I have to be fair here, I'm not being sexist, I'm trying to be fair, it was the women who kept saying you need to understand the importance of social capital. Social capital, how people get on in communities. And recognise it's not just about material and infrastructure and financial capital. You want functioning communities. And indeed, I came to see that that was very important, and it shaped a great deal of what we did in regional development in government. The Regional Partnerships Program, for example, saw us saying to communities, in effect, if you have a project that you think will make a difference in your community, we will help you fund it. But you must do the hard work in establishing the need, establishing the blueprint, and identifying, explaining to us why it will make a difference, and we will then come a considerable way towards funding it with you. So that put the hard work into the intellectual case and into, if you like, finding some dough, and then we would partner with them. And I think that was a valuable understanding. And indeed, I did notice time and time and time again in rural communities, I can think of many within a couple of hours' drive of here, but particularly the smaller ones, where there'd been a spirit of we've been deserted, no one cares, no one appreciates what we've done, nothing's the same, you can't even do your basic shopping, stroke, banking, post a letter in our country town. And that sense of alienation drove a great deal of political upheaval, manifested itself in the whole One Nation thing and so forth. But time and time again we found that if you had a few local movers and shakers, community leaders, if you worked with them to rebuild, for want of a better term, that social capital, when you had a small community pulling together to get something like a multi-purpose centre, or a telecentre, or whatever it happened to be, or an aged care facility, or whatever, by the time they pulled it all together, and often they then had a remarkable little community centre that might have even had a coffee shop or something attached to it, a lot of them did, there was a whole new atmosphere in the place, and people actually felt that the broader community, i.e. the taxpayer, through Canberra, sounds like a contradiction in terms, but you know, it is possible, cared enough to draw alongside them and to try and do something about giving them back some basic identity and a focal point at local community level. So I do think that was a great realisation. With it came the recognition that there's a very sound case for infrastructure. Now this is an area that Canberra very infrequently gets. The major parties and the senior bureaucracies have immense difficulty getting their minds around the need for infrastructure. The reason is actually quite simple. Governments' budgets now are consumed by social spending. Consumed by it. You've got the great health debate going on at the moment. But when you look at the Commonwealth budget, I know more about that than I do about the state's budget, so I think they're probably even worse. A huge amount of the spending is entitlement driven. That is to say, you have entitlements to aged pensions, to unemployment benefits, to disability pensions, to a whole range of programs and so forth that cost the taxpayer money. There's very, very little money left in the pot now unless you increase taxes for what's called discretionary expenditure. Governments can up it or down it without affecting somebody's entitlement, if you see what I'm saying by that. And so the major areas of discretionary expenditure have boiled down now to the point where they are in fact defence and infrastructure. Now Australia has been spending more on defence in recent years, but I'll be blunt with you, I think we needed to. The world is a dangerous place. Europe has, you'll think, as Europhiles amongst you that I've got it into Europe today, but they've skated really on defence on the coattails of the Americans really now since the Second World War. So governments in this country have now recognised for some time that we haven't been spending a high enough percentage of our GDP on defence. That's squeezed infrastructure even more. And the difficulty in getting AusLink up, which was the National Transport Plan, which actually continues to this day and is seeing some serious upgrading of our major highways, of the Australian Rail Track Corporation. You've all seen those badges around the place. We closed down the old train system the Commonwealth tried to run on the different gauges. Said we ought to do it the same way we do road. Taxpayer buys and owns the road system, but the private sector then puts the trucks on the roads, stroke, in the case of rail, locos, and trains on the track. And that's been a major reform. New South Wales took a long time, but they ceded control of the interstate track network and huge amounts of money are being invested in it. Productivity improvement's been enormous. There was a subset of AusLink. It's called Roads to Recovery. You will have all seen those signs. It was a classic example of how rural productivity was being held back by very poor infrastructure and increasingly held back because local councils couldn't afford to maintain, let alone upgrade, the inadequate roads. Adequate at the time, but not by 2000 or so when we introduced the program, those little local roads that, if you think of it as a circulatory system in the body, are the out-of-sight capillaries and so forth that ultimately hook up the veins upon which the whole body for good health depends. And you know, on what Canberra calls a BCR, a benefit-cost ratio, you can't make a local road stack up. Now, nearly everything we do in the bush, that we farm, that we produce, that we deliver, that we export, starts its life on a little local road, yet Canberra's economic models can't make them stack up, so they say you shouldn't fund them. Now, going back to the social capital argument, the CWA, Country Women's Association, published a very good paper some years ago saying that of all of the needs of country women, roads came first, because whether it was your health, whether it was the kids' education, whether it was your social life, you had to be able to get to them. So there's an economic argument that's not recognised by Canberra's modelling, and a social argument that's so easily overlooked for decent local roads. I remember one bureaucrat choking with indignation. I said to him, OK, well, you show me the BCRs for curbing and guttering in Sydney, Melbourne and Canberra, because they don't stack up either. But no one suggests that people in urban Australia shouldn't have curbed and gutted local streets, do they? So that sort of infrastructure aspect is also very important. It is one of the few areas, this is the other message, that treasuries are very reluctant to acknowledge, but it's true. One of the few areas where investment produces actual returns for the economy and therefore the taxpayer. They are, if you like, genuine investments. Let me make some final comments and then seek to take any questions for what it's worth. Since leaving politics, one of the things that I have been involved in is, of course, Eastern Star Gas. Eastern Star Gas is now the largest remaining independent gas producer, I think, in the country. We are producing now. There's a power station right here nearby Narrabri that's running 24/7, producing electricity. And there's a lot of blue sky in front of us. It's a world-class reserve, a resource, right here in Narrabri. We're largely unobtrusive. We're working in anything but prime agricultural land, mostly, at this point in time. But I'm very aware that there are a lot of issues there in relation to the relationship between extractive industries and agriculture. We are a company that's grown organically here. Less than a decade old, really. We now employ a reasonable number of people. Last year probably put something of the order of 15 million directly into the economy. Multiplier effect, we estimate, took it to about 23 million. Assuming that the size of the resource that we now know we have is carried forward in the way that is likely, you will eventually see a very significant number of people, somewhere between 1 and 200 involved in construction, another 75 to 100 or so full-time people. And they will have a range of skills and professional backgrounds and what have you, again, diversifying the community in a social sense as well as adding to it economically. But I do not want to shy away from the issue that I know that many of you will be concerned about, the previous speaker touched on: how do we develop healthy relationships between mining and agriculture? Well, there will be times, I think, when there will be very real difficulties. As a farmer, I have to say to you, I sincerely do respect the argument that says that agriculturally prime land is being swallowed up at an unacceptable rate around the world. It's needed now, and it'll be needed even more in the future. And we should not play dice with its future. We must not play dice with its future. Having said that, for all of the reasons I've outlined, where it is possible for the two to coexist, in many cases it'll be relatively straightforward. We have not experienced any significant difficulties as a company here ourselves. We're not miners, of course, we're drillers, and there's a big difference, but we've worked very hard at it, and we found it reasonably straightforward. And I think it's fair to say, I think I'm a reasonable judge of these things, we enjoy very strong support in this local community. Always got the detractors, that's life. I've met a farmer who doesn't have a detractor either. But generally speaking, we've managed that relationship well, and I've been very keen to do so. I joined it because I have, personally, a real interest in this area. I represented it for a long time. I'm very attached to this community. I'm not saying that just because I'm here. Wouldn't make much difference to most of you whether I did or not. But it's a very interesting, a vibrant community, a look-ahead community, a diversified community with a range of activities other than agriculture, research-based community and so forth. And I think that the regional development opportunities are significant and they are interesting to me. But there's another reason. As a farmer, I know that I need land, I need water to produce food. There's something else I have to have, energy. And for a long time, I think this country's taken its energy future far too lightly. We've got masses of coal, masses of uranium, we know that. We now find we've got masses of gas. That's fortunate. That is fortunate. Because as a food producer, I don't know how many of you are broadly aware that an average Western family now pours as much oil into their refrigerator every year as they do into the family car. What's that mean? It's a simple way of saying that on average, the production of our foodstuffs consumes as much oil every year on a family-by-family basis as our family car does. We are utterly, indeed I would say hopelessly, and quite frighteningly dependent upon oil for food production. And in Australia's case, the problem is somewhat exacerbated by the fact that we are very rapidly running out of our own oil. A very respected engineer who works for General Motors Holden commented recently that he had a real concern that at some stage in the next 5 to 10 years, Australia may be the first country in the world to find that it cannot secure the oil that it needs anymore on a regular basis. Now, I don't know how accurate that is, but I do know that the end of cheap oil is almost certainly upon us. Cheap oil, I'm not saying that the end of oil, but I'm saying the end of cheap oil. And I do know that Australia is running its reserves down enormously. Our trade imbalance has a great deal to do with the amount of oil we import. Alternative forms of energy, particularly including gas, which can be converted into transport fuel and the sort of fuels that agriculture will be needing in the future, interests me very greatly indeed. So we need, I think, to think these broader issues through when we're focused on our particular worries at home. Let me comment then on just one other area, property rights. I never cease to be amazed by how slow many senior politicians and bureaucrats are in this country to understand that the key to wealth creation is investment security. A very stark illustration of this emerged when I was putting the National Water Initiative together. I had a particularly brilliant statistician, in fact he was the son of a one-time Australian chief statistician in Canberra, who did some work for us on water security in Victoria versus New South Wales. And along the Murray River, we found that a quantity of water on the Victorian side of the border generated vastly greater wealth and many more jobs than the same quantity of water on the northern side, and it was all related to investment security. All related to the certainty that a farmer has or doesn't have when they go to their bank to borrow, as they almost invariably have to do, to move to better production systems, which are almost invariably better in economic and environmental terms. And in Victoria, you could put a plan before the bank and you could tell him what your water security was. You did it in New South Wales, you couldn't. Result, vastly inferior economic and environmental outcomes on the New South Wales side of the border. So the National Water Initiative set out to clearly establish what farmers' rights were, are, in relation to the use of water. Nothing saddens me more about the way in which a debate has been mishandled since I stepped down in 1995 than that particular area, but there's no point in me crying over spilt milk except to make the observation today that we need to keep pushing this issue. Of course there are, in relation to the resources that we as farmers use, issues of the common good, the need to look after the environment and all of those sorts of things, but the right to farmers, to investment security, and the community's interest in that investment security must also be taken into account. And if you look at the new legislation pertaining to water in the Murray-Darling Basin, you find that there is almost no reference to the values that concern many of the people in this area right now, feeding people. Food production is important. That is a value. And it is heavily dependent upon the security that farmers have over the resources that they use in their production, from which we all benefit. So that is a debate that needs to be vigorously pursued, logically and sensibly pursued, and I wish those involved in it all success for sensible outcomes. For those of you who are not, can I say to you, it is important. It is right that farmers are highlighting this. It does need to be worked through properly and sensibly, keeping not only the farmers' interests in mind, but also the fact that we feed many people, many of them, most of them not Australian, and that production is needed. Finally, let me say this. Involvement's important. I have noticed a very worrying tendency in rural communities to be very cynical about the political process at local, state and federal government level. Indeed, when the children used to come to Canberra in the school groups, it didn't take very much to establish that they'd been filled with a very unhealthy, so there's healthy scepticism, there's unhealthy cynicism, an unhealthy cynicism about Canberra and the players therein. And this leads to all sorts of disastrous outcomes in the long term. Indeed, let me really be blunt about this. The European Commission is now spending a fortune on trying to establish why most Europeans are too apathetic to bother voting. And in a very interesting and insightful essay I read on it recently, reference was made to the historian Toynbee, Arnold Toynbee, who wrote in the mid-70s, shortly before he died, that the dying throes of all the great civilisations that have collapsed over time have been, firstly, a giving over into selfishness, people just worrying about number one, not their neighbour, not their community, and then finally apathy, which says, well, I might have a problem, but somebody else is going to have to fix it. We can't afford that in rural Australia, but both tendencies, I have to say, are pretty evident. And sometimes they can be evident when somebody picks up a single issue that's pressed their button that has to do with their self-interest. And what can often happen then is that can distort the debate in the context of what I've been talking about, the need to take a sensible whole of industry, indeed whole of nation view, depending on what is relevant. What do I take out of that? I needn't talk to you. You're involved. You're here. That's great. But we need to watch this tendency in our community. We need to encourage our children in particular to be prepared to put up their hand if they have the ability, the opportunity and the responsibility to have a go at running for local government. If I had a dollar for every time I've heard people say, I wish we could get more people to run for local government, I'd be a wealthy man. And you say to them, well, why don't you have a go? Sometimes they'd even say, I wish we had a better federal member. And I'd say, well, that's terrific. Why don't you have a go? You know, they're always too busy cutting people's hair or driving a cab or sitting on the tractor to do it. And the more they knew about what ought to be done, the busier they were. Well, we need to fight selfishness and apathy. So the things that you're talking about, Leith, are very important. I feel very passionately about them. Don't pretend that there are any easy answers. But we are fortunate enough to live in a fully functioning, vibrant democracy. We need to be involved. We need to pursue good, sound policy. And we need to do it with a greater sense of unity, because we produce much, but we're relatively few in numbers. Thanks. Happy to take any questions if there's any time.
I'm sure all of you have got questions for John. He is going to stay for morning tea, but I've been a pretty poor chair and managed the time badly, so I'm afraid we need to move on. Please join me again in thanking John.